Well, they want to help limit emissions. There's already a tax on carbon and sugar. Now the next global levy could very well be meat. That's right. Some investors are betting governments around the world will find a way to start taxing meat production as they aim to improve public health and hit emission targets set in the Paris Climate Agreement, of which we are no longer a part of. Socially focused investors are starting to push companies to diversify into plant protein or even suggest livestock producers use a shadow price of meat similar to an internal carbon price to estimate future costs. Boy, they think of everything, don't they? In a moment, Josh Tikal joins us. We'll talk about his work, Kiss the Ground, How the Food You Eat Can Reverse Climate Change, Heal Your Body, and Ultimately Save Our World. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Josh Tikal with us, activist, filmmaker, author, has worked as an energy and environmental media consultant for the United States Congress, members of the Australian Parliament, the Department of Energy, as well as numerous private companies and individuals. Tikal has traveled nationwide in his vegetable oil-powered veggie van, his hand-built, custom-engineered veggie car, Datsun 240Z sports car, embarking on its first U.S. tour back in 2003. Welcome to the program, Josh Tikal. Josh, welcome to the show.
George, thanks so much for having me.
I remember back in my St. Louis days, Josh, when I was doing a show called the Nighthawk Program, I had a group in that had a car that ran on hemp oil, and they went all over the place with this. Was that similar to your veggie van?
Yeah, I was kind of at the forefront of all of that. I wrote a book called From the Fryer to the Fuel Tank, how to make cheap, clean fuel from vegetable oil. And it just started this crazy biodiesel revolution. Of course, this was back in the 90s. And alternative fuels, alternative energy, electric cars, all of that stuff had not yet taken hold.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, I grew up in Louisiana, and I watched members of my family get sick, get cancers, lymphoma, leukemia, all of that stuff, because no one knows this, but the rate of cancer in the what they call the cancer corridor by all the oil refineries is 1,000 times the national average. So as a kid, ooh, I was very science-oriented. I wanted to find cleaner ways of doing all of the wonderful technological things that we did without hurting the environment, without hurting people.
Why is it as kids it kind of shapes our foundation when we become adults, doesn't it? Same thing happened to me. I wanted to uncover, you know, paranormal stories. I was obsessed with it. Look at me now.
Exactly. You know, you just follow this trail of breadcrumbs. I had no idea that I'd be doing what I'm doing now.
Well, I'm glad you are, because we need more watchdogs like you, Josh. We're going through incredible times. I want to tell you from the outset, I'm not a believer in man-made climate change. I think we're in an Earth cycle. However, I think pollution is another issue, and I think we're polluting this planet like crazy.
We are polluting the planet like crazy. And you know, funny enough, you mentioned that. In the book, Kiss the Ground, we uncover a totally different side of things, because we're all used to this sort of this very, you know, trite Al Gore, CO2, polar bear sort of version of the universe. And Kiss the Ground, the book, it's all about a very real thing that's happening all over the world. It's called desertification. And when we desertify soils, we change microclimates. We change the local climate, the local rainfall right above that soil. That's what most people don't realize. The big, big thing we reveal in the book.
That story I just had before you came on about wanting to tax meat, what is all that about?
Well, here's the thing. There's a huge push in the environmental community, a very big anti-meat push. There are a couple big films out right now, a couple more big films coming out next year, all about not eating meat. Now, the misnomer is that all meat is bad, right? So this divides people, because let's face it, the vast majority, 99% of people eat some kind of meat. Well, if we step back a bit and we go, what's really going on here? Nature does not farm without animals. You can't show me any place in the world where nature farms without animals.
That's right.
But what we've done is we've put these animals in feedlots. We've subsidized, grossly subsidized. You and I, George, we pay tax dollars so that we can subsidize these feedlots through these terrible crops that we grow for them. And, of course, then we've got sick animals, antibiotics, sick human beings. The whole cycle is just totally messed up. So what we show in this movement, the regenerative agriculture movement, cows can actually be something that can heal soil. And depending on where you are in your beliefs in climate change, they're going to pull CO2. They're going to pull these climate gases out of the atmosphere. That's not really the main thing. The main thing is building back our soil, because the soil is the foundation for civilization.
Let's go through the 10 shocking truths revealed in your book, Kiss the Ground. We'll go through each area one by one. Let me throw them out to you, Josh, and have you explain them. In our last hour with you, next hour, we'll take phone calls from our concerned and interested listeners, and they are, you will find, the best in town. You were on with Lisa Garr a few years ago, weren't you?
Yep, Lisa Garr. She's a fantastic interviewer,
yeah,
isn't she?
She's a great person. She really is. She's got a heart of gold, too. The Green Revolution. Tell me about that.
Well, see, we had this, George, as you know, and many, many listeners, many folks listening will remember this, but in the late 1970s, early 80s, there was a huge push in America and overseas to make more food, especially for Asia. We had rice that was infused with vitamins. We had all these new chemicals. And around that time, we started to talk about, but didn't do, we started to talk about genetic engineering for food, right? And the idea was that we could produce more calories per acre because we knew we were going to have more people. Now, two things happened. One, we did produce more calories per acre. That is true. It did work out. However, the second thing that happened is we used precipitously, exponentially more synthetic nitrogen and more chemicals, pesticides. So we did a little incremental increase in per acre yield, but we did an exponential increase in inputs. All of those inputs ended up in our bodies, in the air, in our drinking water. This is why places like Des Moines have poisoned water. This is why the Gulf of Mexico is dying, because of this Green Revolution, this push to industrialize food, right? It
exactly.
Of course, devoided these calories of nutrition, but we produced more calories. The secret to this whole system, though, is that we were degrading the very resource we rely on for food. We lost a third, 33%, one-third of farmable land on planet Earth since the Green Revolution started.
And that was very rich land, wasn't it?
This was rich topsoil that was, up until that very moment, it was functioning to grow our food. So I don't know about you, I'd rather grow a little less food and have a lot more acres than grow a little more food and have a lot less acres.
Meanwhile, as you've written, the population has gone up by several billion people.
We basically gutted our ability to produce food, and we exponentially increased the number of hungry mouths on planet Earth all at the same time.
Climate change, you say, can be reversed. How are we going to do that?
Well, again, we're looking at a very localized model. You know, most people, when they hear climate change, if they don't believe it, they just shut down. But what I want you to think about is, have you ever been in a city on a hot day? And it feels like the heat is literally coming off the pavement.
Right, and it probably is.
It is, indeed, because solar radiation from the sun only has three pathways when it hits the Earth. It can hit a plant and turn into photosynthesis. It can hit the ground and basically be absorbed by the ground, or it can hit the ground and bounce off and go back into the atmosphere. So when we create dry, hard, barren surfaces, you ever travel to our fair state of California, or for that matter, if you ever go to the Midwest of the United States, if you ever go in the middle of Australia, anywhere they produce tremendous amounts of food, guess what? They clear the land.
Yeah.
And all that remains are these crops, these rows of crops. Go out, look between the crops. What's there? Bare, hard ground. So what's happened is we've created these heat vortexes. And these vortexes of heat in these places push the clouds away. When you push the clouds away, you don't get rain. The opposite is true when you're in a rainforest. Most of the heat energy, most of the solar radiation hits those plants. Transpiration, water comes out through the plants. Guess what? You get a local water cycle. 50% of our water is supposed to come from the local water cycle. When we destroy it, we create micro deserts. That's what we're doing in places like California. That's why we have these huge wildfires. Wildfires are natural. Huge wildfires, not so natural.
Josh, how bad are the toxins in the air?
the toxins that we are, you know, we talk about many different types of toxins, right? So we've got the petroleum toxins. Those are the ones that we're accustomed to. The thing that people don't realize is now we've created a terrible cycle. We talk about this in Kiss the Ground, the book. Folks can find more information, kissthegroundbook.com. But here's the crazy thing. We're spraying 3 pounds of toxic pesticides per American per year. Most of that is aerosol, meaning it's in the air.
It's in the air. We breathe that stuff.
Not good. Not good.
Not good at all. And babies are breathing it in too, aren't they?
They are. Of course, all of this stuff goes much more detrimental to young children and elderly adults. 200 peer-reviewed studies on the deleterious effects of toxic pesticides, the vast majority of them point to ADHD, pediatric cancer, lymphoma, even reduced IQ as a result of exposure. And I'm not talking about acute exposure. I'm talking about chronic exposure, the kind of exposure we all have to pesticides for our food.
Well, I got to tell you, Josh, if you've ever gone through the cancer ward of a children's hospital in any city you may be in, it's devastating. I mean, it's the saddest thing. And these little kids are there. They're fighters. They are there to try to survive. But I always wonder, how in God's name do they get cancer? They're innocent. They're clean. What happens? It's got to be environmental.
Well, we know definitively now, epigenetic science and epigenetic geneticists tell us that the precipitous and exponential rise that we've seen in cancer cases, especially in the West, especially in the United States, over the past 10, 20 years, absolutely is not hereditary. So we typically had that belief for years and years and years. Cancer industry, the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, everybody said, this is hereditary. Well, we now know epigenetics are genetic traits that are turned on or off by an environmental factor. Let's look at all the environmental factors we're exposed to. The number one thing that has increased exponentially is pesticides on our food. 3 pounds per American per year.
Does washing help or eliminate it?
Absolutely. Washing helps. There are certain products that are environmentally benign, meaning they biodegrade when they are mixed with water, that will help reduce the amount of skin-laden pesticides. The problem is non-organic food is sprayed with a tremendous amount. A lot of this is happening right before harvest. So it's in the wheat germ, it's in the soy kernel, it's in the actual food that we're eating.
Not good.
Not good.
You've talked about heat waves and droughts, of course, but you say that the incredible weather that we're having lately, you know, we went years without a major hurricane, and now all of a sudden we've had at least three this season, and the season, of course, is technically over, but who knows what's going to happen. But you say it's not caused by strange things that we would think normally, that these patterns are caused by something else.
I am a firm believer, especially after this, you know, Kiss the Ground is a result of 10 years of research. I've been to most farming regions in the United States, traveled overseas, looked at agriculture, production agriculture all over the world. What we are seeing is very simple. When you clear soil, I mean, I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of acres to do production agriculture and to build suburban environments, what happens, the first thing we do is we channel the water off of that soil. We start to dry that soil out. Where does that water go? Well, if it's not transpiration through plants, that means it's either going into the ocean or it's evaporating. It's going up into the atmosphere. So now let's fast forward through time. Let's look at Houston. Let's look at this huge hurricane we have. Tremendous quantities of water. Nowhere for the water to go. So what's happening? First thing, we have way more water in the atmosphere. We don't talk about water. We always talk about carbon dioxide. I want to talk about water. We have evaporated the water off of our soil, so we've got it in the atmosphere. Two, when the water falls, it doesn't fall in the small water cycle, which is transpiration through a tree or transpiration through grass. You go out in the early morning, feel that grass. It's wet. Why is it wet? You're going to say, because I have a sprinkler system.
Yeah, right. Or the dew, right?
The dew, that's what we're talking about. That is 40 to 50% of our water. When we clear soil and we dry it out and we harden it out, that 40 to 50% is up in the atmosphere, right? So the third thing that happens, boom, we only get the waterborne cycle, the large water cycle from the ocean. That's the big torrential downpours. And they get bigger and bigger because we have more water up in the atmosphere. When they hit the land, they can't infiltrate. Those water droplets can't get in the soil because the soil is too hard. Guess what? Flooding. So when I talk about climate change, I don't talk about the whole planet. I don't talk about CO2. I talk about Houston. I talk about Puerto Rico. I talk about the California wildfires. I talk about the drought that is constantly plaguing the Midwestern farmers, because these are real issues that people every day face, and they're reversible. They're absolutely reversible.
Is everything reversible?
No. No.
It's not.
Okay. Everything is not reversible. No. Especially things like California aquifers, aquifers worldwide. We're at about a 50% decline in global aquifers. Many aquifers, they are really dependent on clay. Clay, once it compacts, it can't recharge.
What do you think of fracking?
I think this is a technology that we gotta continue and investigate fracking, but from my experience, and again, I live in Ventura County, California, tremendous.
You're in the fire alley, aren't you?
Tremendous. Yep, fire alley. Oh, look, we were a few thousand feet from the Thomas wildfire, almost consumed our entire home this past week. We're evacuated in Los Angeles. But listen, here's the reality of fracking, okay? Most people, they're going to talk about earthquakes. I'm going to talk again about water. For every 1 gallon...
You're big into water and land, and we'll talk more about that later. Go ahead.
Water's the big issue. Real quick, for every 1 gallon of produced natural gas that comes out of a frack well, there's about 55 gallons of produced water. What's in that produced water? This is the water you inject down in the well to flush the well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, selenium, radioactive elements, toxic elements, drilling lubricants, all of those things, for most of the oil and gas industry, they say, no, we clean all that stuff out. I have seen the produced water. It is black as night. What are they required to do with that? Reinject it into wells from which agriculture gets its water. They're spraying it on our crops.
Jeez.
I don't want that on my food.
No. Well, why did they do this?
Well, you got to produce the natural gas. And ironically, a huge thing that we use natural gas for in the United States is to make synthetic fertilizer to put on our crops, because our land is so degraded because we destroyed the soil.
Unbelievable.
So now we're toxifying the land and we're toxifying the water just to try and grow a crop on sick soil.
Josh, where do people get the book, Kiss the Ground?
KissTheGroundBook.com. Of course, it's on Amazon. Of course, you can get it at your local bookseller. Barnes & Noble's across the country have a few. Pick them up. Give them as Christmas gifts. Great book for everyone.
And the website, KissTheGroundBook.com?
That's it, KissTheGroundBook.com.
And we've got your name linked up also at CoastToCoastAM.com. Are you on social network at all?
Of course. Yep, Facebook, Twitter, all of those great things.
Spell your last name for everybody.
T is in Tom, I-C-K-E-L-L, Josh Tickell.
We're going to come back and talk more about the rest of the 10 shocking truths revealed in his book, Kiss the Ground. And then in the last hour of the program, we'll open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to chat with him and chime in as well. And welcome back to Coast. We are back with Josh Tickell, his latest book, Kiss the Ground. Josh, once topsoil is gone, it's gone, isn't it?
Well, here's the conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom tells us it takes about 500 years to build an inch of topsoil. We are seeing, with regenerative agriculture, which we detail in the Kiss the Ground book, kisstheground.com, we are seeing topsoil being built in as little as 1 to 2 years.
That's amazing.
It is incredible. It is incredible. But here's the incredible thing that scientists have told us for some time, but now we're seeing it over and over and over again. Different sites have something called ecological memory. Ecological memory is the sum of the spores, the molds, the fungus, the bacteria, the organisms that may be dormant in the soil. We see this in deserts when it rains, very, very unusual rains that come once every 100 years or something. The desert will bloom. Where did those flowers come from? These are seeds that are stored in the sand. Okay, so when we start the process of regenerative agriculture, of revitalizing the fungi, of revitalizing the macrofauna, so I'm talking about worms, they actually build soil together very quickly, and you can actually build topsoil in as little as 1 to 3 years.
Jeez, yeah. What genius would have come up with that, huh?
Well,
when they talk about intelligent design, there's got to be one.
It is, the deeper you go into this stuff, George, the more it boggles the mind. There are more healthy organisms in a handful of healthy soil than human beings that have ever lived on planet Earth.
I mean, do you think a universe by itself, Josh, would create a system, a mechanism, even though we've been in droughts, that would literally make it rain because it's critical for plants to survive, but to create that kind of system? I mean, how does that happen?
Look, there is no way you can study this stuff and go as deep as I've gone and not appreciate that there is the higher guiding force.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it
is. Call it God, whatever you want.
Whatever it is, there is something that runs through the, mycorrhizal fungi, just an example. These guys, these can be hundreds of thousands of acres large. Okay, one fungus that can be over tens of thousands of acres large. And it literally will transmit from a tree that needs a mineral to a plant that could be a mile away that has that mineral. It can transmit that information and convey that mineral through a complex exchange of carbon under the ground. That is mind-boggling. How does that even work?
But what are the odds of the planet being able to have on it plants that can be used as medicines to kill off disease?
There you go.
I mean, it's just amazing. Let's talk a little bit, Josh, about cows, and they're getting blamed for all this methane gas and carbon monoxide.
Well, cows,
and dioxide.
Cows have become the bane of environmental existence. They are the new SUV, the new SUV. And the funny thing is, if we go back, let's go back to the birth of human civilization. Let's go back to the Fertile Crescent. This is where, when the ice sheets retreated some 10,000 years ago, humans began to sow grains. And from the Fertile Crescent, we can genetically track the movement of human beings around the world because we can track the lactose tolerance gene. And we know that cows, or a predecessor of cows, a bison-like creature, is what they brought with them, okay? So cows have been part of agriculture for 10,000 years. And for 10,000 years, we had a relatively stable amount of gases in the atmosphere. In fact, when Europeans arrived on the North American continent, there were about 60 million buffalo or bison roaming this continent. Now, today, we have about 60 million head of cattle. Same thing. Cattle, four stomachs, they're ruminants. Bison, four stomachs, they're ruminants. Cattle eat grass. Bison eat grass. Here's the difference. We put cattle in feedlots. The bison actually roamed in a circular pattern. They created what I call the buffalo bank account, the rich soils from which we eat today. So what we're seeing in regenerative agriculture is you can't perform regenerative agriculture without the use of a ruminant. Like, the cattle are part of the system. But when we shove them in feedlots, they create a tremendous amount of pollution. And that's what people are upset about. And so they go, oh, all cows are bad. And it's like, well, no. Let's look at how we manage these creatures. Let's look at what we're doing to them. This is unnatural, therefore we have unnatural results.
You have talked about the planet losing landmass. How bad is the situation?
The worst estimates of where we are at globally with soil are that we have 60 harvests left, period.
That's it?
that's it. So that's a pretty shocking and absolutely provable trajectory. Here's the thing. You know, let's take it down to the average person who's listening tonight. You're listening to this. You're driving your car. You're somewhere in the world. Think about this. Have you ever seen soil blow across a field? Have you ever been out to a place where they grow crops or driving by and you see that dust come across that field? Well, if that field's about an acre big, then the amount of topsoil that weighs a ton is the thickness of a sheet of paper. A ton of topsoil is the thickness of a sheet of paper on an acre. So if you see that soil blowing, that's tons and tons and tons of soil blowing. Where does it go? It goes into the rivers. It goes into the oceans. It goes off the land. The land is where we need it to be in order to grow the crops that we eat. So it's very serious. We've lost 33%, about a third of our land, in the last 40 years.
You have talked about tilling and that it's not as good as people think. How come?
We have a saying. It, you know, Kiss the Ground, again, is the name of the book, kissthegroundbook.com. This is the book that tells you how to reverse these processes, whether it's a planter box in your apartment or your backyard garden or your farm. Here's what we know about tilling. We have a saying, if you till it, you kill it. What I'm talking about is the mycorrhizal fungi that runs just underneath the soil. Those fungi are the key to soil holding water. When soil holds water, soil is full of life. When soil is full of life, it can grow more life. Many people think that plants get their minerals from above ground. They don't. The plants actually get their vitamins, their minerals, their nutrients from the microorganisms below ground. When we till, we run these huge plates over the ground. We stir up the ground. We break the fungi. We destroy the life in the soil. The carbon, the water, all of the minerals, the nutrients, gets lost and the soil starts to erode. So we advocate no tilling, and the farmers that we look at who are not tilling are growing way more food per acre, and some of them are making tremendous amounts of money.
Now, what about land that has nothing grown on it, good or bad?
Bad. Okay. Bad. And I hate to be like categorically things are either, you know, but generally it's bad. What we want to, you know, the conventional thinking, fallow land. You've got to fallow the land. Okay, we've grown a crop, now we have to fallow land. That thinking is absolutely wrong. What we want to do is we want to grow a mixture of species, a cover crop that may be 10, 12, 15, 20 different species. Those species will pull water into the soil. They'll pull carbon into the soil. Carbon is the basis of life. We want the carbon in the soil. The reason soil is black is because of the carbon. You pick up soil, it's not black. There's no carbon in it.
No life.
It lost its life.
Yep.
Yep.
Exactly. You have talked about bad land. How conceivable is it to make it good again, and how long would it take?
I'll give you an example. There's a place in China called the Loess Plateau. It is where the Han Dynasty came from. It is really where the birth of Chinese civilization came from. It's been farmed for thousands of years. Up until the 1980s, it was dry, rocky. It looked like Saudi Arabia on a good day, okay? Not a fun place to be. The people were poor, nothing to speak of in terms of water, nothing to speak of in terms of income. A group of international regenerative agriculture, ecological restoration specialists came in. Within 20 years, they fully restored this desert place into a lush ecosystem. The people got to keep the land. The income they produce is now theirs. They integrated animals back into the system. They grew trees. They stabilized the soil. They grew topsoil. They restored an area the size of France with manual implements. I mean, no tractors, no internet, no Wi-Fi. They restored that land to health within 20 years with nothing. With all the modern technology we have, we can do it in 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years?
3 to 5 years.
That's dramatic, isn't it?
It is, and it is using the intelligence of nature. It is using the intelligence that we've developed through agriculture, but in concert with nature, nature first. What we know is if we don't till the soil, if we don't use harsh chemicals, if we implement cover crops, if we implement animal implementation in the right way, topsoil can grow back very fast, soil nutrition can grow back very fast, you can grow a tremendous amount more food per acre, you can feed more people, and you can make more money.
We're with Josh Tickell, and we're talking about his work, Kiss the Ground. Josh, where would farming be today without subsidies?
Well, let me put it to you this way. George, we subsidize the American farm industry to the tune of about $1 million per farm per year.
What's that add up to?
About $20 to $25 billion a year.
And your definition of subsidy is what?
It goes through something called the Commodity Crop Insurance Program. So if you're a farmer, Farmer Joe, you're in the middle of Iowa, you say, this year I'm going to farm 2,000 acres. Average farm in the U.S. is about 2,500 acres. You go, I'm going to farm 2,000 acres, but before I plant a seed, let me see what crops they're insuring this year. Oh, turns out it's corn and soy. It's always corn and soy, by the way. Let's see. I can get a better price for corn than I can for soy this year. I'm going to go ahead and plant corn. Now, the average farmer needs to make about $20 an acre to survive. But farmers in the U.S. are making about $2 an acre. Who pays the difference? We do.
We do.
And here's how it works. The government sets a minimum price guarantee for that crop. Of course, the crop isn't going to make the farmer that much money. So the farmer comes back at the end of the year and they go, well, I only made this much money. The government goes, that's okay, Joe. Here's your check. Keep on farming. Better luck next year.
Now, without the subsidy, what happens?
Well, a couple of things happen without the subsidy. The first thing that happens is we don't have all that field corn to put into the feedlots to make sick animals, to make sick humans. That's the first thing. The only reason we grow field corn, it's the primary crop in the United States, is because of subsidies.
Right.
That's the same for soybeans as well. Okay, so the first thing that happens is farmers will look to diversify, because if you're not getting a handout, which I don't believe that we should be given an entire industry consistently a handout, if you're not being given that handout, you're going to look to actually make money. Well, how do you make money? Not by growing corn and soy. You make money by growing things that people want to eat. Tomatoes, bananas, all of these diversified fruits and vegetables the doctors tell us we should be eating for our health. So, you know, it's a funny thing. Less than 5% of the United States is planted with fruits and vegetables. The doctors tell us they should be 50% of our diet.
What about the cornfields that are being grown for ethanol?
Ethanol is a tricky subject, and as you know from my background, I've been a big promoter of biofuels, big supporter of alternative energy. So, you know, I've kind of, I wouldn't say I've turned tail, but I would say this. The ethanol industry, as it stands today, is really a Band-Aid on a cancer. We cannot fix the American farming program by giving farmers a way to sell fuel from a crop that is destroying their farms. That's not going to work long term. It's only going to put them up for a short period of time. Ethanol's great if you make it from waste products. We know it runs cleaner. We know it burns better in engines. But it ain't going to solve the American farming system, because that farming system is broken from a government standpoint.
How devastating are GMOs?
Another tricky subject, okay, because so much of the GMO system is patented by the developers of those seeds. They don't want those seeds to be tested. Any test that's done that shows long-term deleterious effects, which they do primarily in France and countries where they are very studious about studying these things, they're showing consistently major epigenetic things happening, mostly in the range of cancers, but the patented companies will discredit those tests. So we can't say definitively that they cause cancer. Here's what we can say. In order to grow a GMO seed, let's say corn, for instance, the main GMO crop in the United States, you have to use the pesticides that go with that seed. So what's corn need? It needs Roundup. What's the primary ingredient in Roundup? Glyphosate, one of the main cancer-causing chemicals sprayed in the United States every single year.
Of course, they deny it, but we know that's the fact.
It's blowing. This is blowing up, and there are lawsuits after lawsuits, not from environmental groups, not from lefty groups, not from California, from farmers who are getting sick, and they're seeing their kids have, you know, lymphoma, leukemia. You know, let's face it. These are chemicals that you have to apply with a Tyvek suit. We're spraying them on our food.
Josh, we're going to come back in just a moment. Final hour to go with you, and we will open up the phone lines. Questions, comments. If you're a farmer, check in with us as well. You're probably up. Not many crops in December, so give us a call.